Now, professor of public policy at UC Berkeley. We'll link to his recent pieces, the first 100-day resistance agenda and Trump's seven techniques to control the media. We'll link to it at democracynow.org. It's now been 146 days since Donald Trump has held a news conference. That does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Sam Malkoff, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Trina Ndura, and Andre Lewis. Special welcome back to Julie Crosby. And thanks to Miguel Noguera, Mike DeFilippo, and Paul Huckabee, as well as Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Give to KBOO today during our end-of-year match. Wrapping up December 31st, donations from all new and increasing members will be matched one-to-one up to $15,000 from the Collins Foundation and SSI Shredding Systems. Give an extra gift today or become a new member, and your membership will be doubled to support independent community media and citizen journalism at KBOO. Thank you.
Tune in Tuesday nights from 8 to 10 p.m. The Melting Pot, featuring DJs, producers, and electronic artists from around the globe. Win tickets and stay up on events each and every Tuesday from 8 to 10 p.m. on The Melting Pot, right here at 90.7 FM KBOO.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
And up next is your Tuesday volunteer-produced evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the City of Portland reports that it has used 100% renewable energy for the current fiscal year. That's up from 71% the year before.
After Trump won the Electoral College yesterday, observers wonder how the Democratic Party will rebuild itself.
And there's an emergency houseless resource drive tomorrow night. We speak live with Amanda Elizabeth from Backpacks of Hope.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, December 20, 2016. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Kanan Schlesinger. A study released today by the Fair Punishment Project found that two-thirds of death row inmates in Oregon are mentally ill, intellectually impaired, or under the age of 21. Six of the 35 prisoners on death row were under 21 when they committed the crime, with nine under the age of 25. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled in 2002 that imposing the death penalty on juveniles or intellectually disabled persons violates their, quote, inherent dignity as a human being. However, that's not stopping Oregon judges from using it. While the death penalty is de facto suspended, on average, one individual per year is sentenced to it. This translates to 1.25% of all murder convictions. On average, a death sentence carries a price tag of $2.3 million.
A new report suggests the U.S. could drastically cut its prison population without endangering the public. Nearly 80% of inmates suffer from a drug addiction or mental illness. KBOO's Audrey Eschride, in partnership with the Oregon News Service, has the story.
Nearly 40% of people are behind bars for no compelling public safety reason, according to a new report. The Brennan Center for Justice report, How Many Americans Are Unnecessarily Incarcerated, looks at state and federal prison populations and suggests numbers could be drastically cut without endangering the public. 54% of the nearly 1.5 million Americans in prison are there for nonviolent offenses. Just as striking is that 79% of prisoners suffer either from drug addiction or mental illnesses. Bob Jundev, head of Disability Rights Oregon, says prisons actually are countertherapeutic for people with mental illnesses.
They tend to be isolated a lot because of behavioral problems, which even makes their illness worse. And prisons and jails just aren't funded and structured to provide the types of services that those folks need.
According to the Oregon Department of Corrections, there are nearly 15,000 people in Oregon state prisons. The state has one federal prison with a population of 1,350. The report details the ways in which states and the federal government could decrease the prison population. It proposes decreasing the number of incarcerated to fewer than 900,000, and at the same time increasing the percent of inmates in prison for violent offenses. Senior counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice, Lauren Brooke Eisen, says many states have already succeeded in reducing the prison population by expanding the use of probation, drug treatment, and reentry programs.
27 states in the past decade have reduced both crime and incarceration. So that's a pretty striking statistic indicating that we don't need these massive prison populations to keep our country safe.
Jundev says Oregon knows what it needs to do to divert people with mental illnesses from prison. He says having more people on the Oregon Health Plan has been a really important step.
But we need to grow our mental health services. We absolutely need to have more housing. Having people on the streets is not only morally offensive, but it just doesn't ultimately pan out in terms of use of public resources.
This is Audrey Eschright for KBOO News.
Southeast Portland's affluent East Moreland neighborhood is moving ahead in a review process for designation on the National Register of Historic Places. The area encompasses approximately 475 acres of Southeast Portland, just south of Reed College. There, many single-family houses are set on large lots that have attracted developers who are interested in developing two houses per lot. The historic district designation would limit changes to structures, landscape, and streetscape. Benefits of the designation are tax credits, grants, and waivers of certain building code requirements. Drawbacks include added costs and complexity for homeowners to modify or upgrade structures. The East Moreland Neighborhood Association submitted the request for historic status, but there are residents on both sides of the issue. The next step will include meetings on February 16th and 17th at the East Moreland Golf Course. Representatives from Oregon State Advisory Committee on Historic Preservation, who are considering the nomination, will speak. If the state committee endorses the nomination, it will go to the National Park Service, which maintains the register.
After being evicted from his home in the Cascadian Terrace Apartments on December 19, Reynaldo Diaz Cabrera shot two apartment complex employees, police said. Officers responded to a call from the apartment building around 12:30 p.m. They found an injured 45-year-old man and a 64-year-old woman and learned that the shooter had fled the area. Police found the suspect, Cabrera, in a vehicle near Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard and Winchell Street. They arrested him without incident and seized a gun as evidence. Cabrera was booked into the Multnomah County Jail on two charges of attempted murder. His arraignment is scheduled for Tuesday.
Two Oregon City High School students could be expelled as the result of a video that was shared Friday on social media. The video shows the students using racial slurs and making derogatory comments about Black students at the school. The students also use a transphobic phrase. It isn't the first instance of racial harassment at the Oregon City School this year. In October, Oregon City High School students organized a walkout after a string of incidents involving hate speech and racial harassment. That was after a group of white students photographed themselves holding a sign that said, quote, "Welcome back to the farm," and followed by the N-word, and included a cartoon of a KKK member in a white hood. In another incident, racist notes were left for a Black student. School administrators have pledged to fully investigate the incident and use disciplinary actions as dictated by the student code of conduct, which can include expulsion.
The City of Portland reported that it has used 100% renewable energy for fiscal year 2015 and 2016, up from 71% the fiscal year before. This means that the city will meet the City Council's 2030 environmental performance objectives. The city is also working on the objective to obtain 15% of its electricity from on-site energy sources like solar and biogas. In the current year, 7% of the city's electricity came from on-site renewable sources. Two installations currently under construction will move the city closer to achieving its on-site energy goal of 15%. The city is also planning its first solar plus storage facility at Fire Station 1 at Southwest NATO Parkway and Ash Street. The project will improve the city's response capability in prolonged power outages and will save $3,300 annually in electricity cost. The city is meeting the rest of its renewable electricity goal by purchasing renewable energy certificates from utility companies. RECs are the accepted legal instrument used to substantiate renewable electricity use claims. This year, the city is buying 128,000 megawatt hours of RECs.
President Obama banned oil and gas drilling in large areas of federally owned land in the Arctic and Atlantic Oceans today. Obama used provisions of the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act of 1953 to protect various underwater canyons running from Massachusetts to Virginia. The drilling ban in Arctic waters was in conjunction with conservation agreements with Canada that ban the future unregulated fisheries, identify sustainable shipping lanes, and seek Native peoples' input on plans for activities in the area. Canada also protected wide areas of their Arctic waters as well. A previous idea that would permit limited drilling off the Atlantic coast was rejected due to the concerns of state governments with adjacent beach property and objections by the U.S. Navy. Former presidents from both parties have invoked the law, and, to date, no subsequent president has ever rescinded a ban. It is unclear whether the current president-elect or a Republican Congress will have the authority to do so.
The Michigan Attorney General's office filed charges today against two former city managers and two former city public works officials for false pretenses and conspiracy to commit false pretenses. The charges against former city managers Darnell Early and Gerald Ambrose, along with Howard Croft and Dougherty Johnson from the Public Works Department, are the latest to stem from a long-running investigation into the tainted Flint water supply. If convicted, Early and Ambrose could face up to 46 years in prison, while Croft and Johnson could receive sentences up to 40 years. Many of the charges are linked to an order that cleared Flint to switch its water source from the Detroit Water and Sewage Department to the Flint River. While bringing charges, State Attorney Bill Shute said there was a, quote, fixation with finances and balance sheets at the expense of public health and safety.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Cutie Pock Talk at 6. And at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather, partly sunny with highs around 45 degrees. Today in history, on this day in 1957, Elvis Presley was drafted at the height of his career. Based in Germany, Presley served in a tank battalion in the 3rd Armored Corps in Friedberg, Germany, during peacetime, eventually reaching the rank of sergeant. The quote of the day is from Elvis, who said, "Truth is like the sun. You can shut it out for a time, but it ain't going away."
The Electoral College met yesterday at state houses across the country. The first faithless elector came from Minnesota. Refusing to cast a vote for Hillary Clinton, he was replaced by an alternate, and all of the state's 10 votes were ultimately cast for the Democrat. Next was in Maine, where one elector cast a vote for Bernie Sanders rather than Clinton. The vote was ruled out of order, and the elector relented in the second pass. Protesters disrupted the vote in Wisconsin and were ushered from the room before the state's electors cast their votes for Donald Trump. As the nation awaits the inauguration, analysts and some Democrats are pondering whether the Democratic Party can regain a competitive edge without significant changes in its leadership and strategy. Evan Davis spoke with activists in Central Ohio who are already working to reform the Democratic Party at the local level.
Ohio lost its status as a swing state in the last election as Donald Trump bested Hillary Clinton by 52-43%. The failure of the Clinton campaign to rally the Democratic Party base may reflect a feeling among some Democratic Party voters that their party leadership is simply out of touch with the concerns of its rank-and-file constituents. Former Ohio Secretary of State Jennifer Bruner has observed this trend since 2010, when she sought her party's nomination to run for the U.S. Senate. The party chose then-Lieutenant Governor Lee Fisher over Bruner in spite of the fact that early polling suggested that Bruner had a better chance of winning in the general election.
When I look at the Democratic Party nationally, they've become very establishment in terms of being affected and swayed by big moneyed interests that typically supported Republicans. We can't take for granted our base. I see some reticence on people's part to step out, to step outside of what they perceive to be the strictures of sometimes overt and covert leaders of the party. And when they do that, when is the revolution ever going to happen?
Speaking to the rank and file was the strong suit of the Bernie Sanders campaign, which emphasized making government more accountable to the electorate. After the Democratic Party primary, the campaign has continued in the form of a citizens' lobby group called Ohio Revolution. Pooja Datta is one of the spokespeople for the Ohio chapter.
I think the Democrats have this tendency of expecting certain blocks of voters to be their firewalls without really being there for them. I want to get beyond that.
Datta's group is forming chapters throughout the state where they plan to field progressive candidates for local offices.
We are going to be working within the party. The way we're looking at it, infrastructure is already built for the Democratic Party, and it's going to take twice as long if we want to build an infrastructure outside of that, so it makes more sense to utilize what we do have. We are looking to run people for city council, for school boards around town. It's sort of the brand new Congress model. Instead of nationally, we're doing it only in Ohio.
Others are focusing on a different kind of reform from within strategy. Will Petrick is with a group called Yes We Can. It has a progressive platform, and it sets its sights on gaining seats in the Ohio Democratic Party's Central Committee, where Petrick now serves as a ward captain.
We thought, what better place to start than the local level? Partly because, you know, these wards, in some cases, there were less than 600 registered Democrats. Some wards had up to 2,000, but it was at a scale where grassroots organizing works.
At a recent party forum in Columbus, all of the candidates spoke of the party's need to do a better job of listening to constituencies that have been overlooked for several election cycles, as well as to adopt a more progressive stance on issues of concern to the economically disadvantaged. But transforming those talking points into action will be necessary to recapture the support of people like Dorian Wingard, an urban African-American professional who voted in November but who chose no candidate in the presidential race.
And my ancestors did not fight, die, and bleed for me to have the right to waste a vote. They did that so I could have the ability and the right to vote. Voting for either one of those candidates would have been a wasted vote, in my opinion.
Like Datta and Petrick's groups, Wingard plans to remain involved in local politics, but as for supporting Democratic Party candidates, he remains skeptical.
I asked the same question about, we're in Columbus, Ohio, so we've had an African-American mayor for almost 18 years prior to the new incoming mayor. And there are parts of the city and this community that looked the exact same when he took office as they did when he left office, while other areas have bloomed and flourished and grown exponentially. I say that to make to point to the Democratic Party's approach. There's been nothing. There's been nothing. The approaches and the policies, be they Democratic or Republican, yield the same end result, which is deficits, which are deficits in our communities, families that are hungry and not able to do what they need to do, unemployment, chronic unemployment and underemployment, homelessness, poor quality education. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. So candidates have to do a little bit more than what they've been doing.
Although some Ohio voters may have been deterred by recent limitations on voting rights, including voter ID requirements, shortened early voting hours, and purges of voter registrations, the undisputedly largest block of voters in this last election were neither Democrats nor Republicans, but simply the ones who chose to stay home. Evan Davis, FSRN, Columbus, Ohio.
It's 5:17. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Perk up, people, for I bring you tidings of great joy. Governor Oops is back. Yes, Rick Perry, the former Texas governor who specialized in putting the goober in gubernatorial, is being brought back from well-earned obscurity in rural Texas to join the menagerie of characters in The Donald Show. For us lovers of low political comedy, Perry is literally an early Christmas gift from on high. Not from heaven, not that high, but from the dizzying heights of Trump Tower. That's where the orange-haired impresario-in-chief has been holding tryouts for his Washington cast, and Perry is a slapstick perfect choice for Trump's bizarre cabinet. Who can forget Perry's classic oops moment during his first fail run for the White House? Campaigning as a far-out right-wing slasher of government services, He boldly declared in a televised debate that, by gollies, he would eliminate three federal agencies entirely, dramatically reeling off the names of his three victims, the Department of Commerce, Department of Education, and alas, as the national TV audience watched in horror, Rick's brain just could not recall the third federal department he planned to kill off. He was roundly ridiculed as being dumber than a dust bunny. But now, proving once again that being even quasi-smart is not a requirement for getting a high political job, Perry has been hired by Trump to be our next Secretary of Energy. Yes, that is the very agency that was third on the Goober's elimination list. He is actually being appointed to head the $32 billion department he could not name during the 2012 presidential race. This is Jim Hightower saying, here's another comic twist in Rick's appointment. While briefly running for president again this go-round, Perry assailed Trump as a, quote, barking carnival act. And now, he's a tail-wagging dog in Donnie's carnival.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Homelessness in the United States has increased nearly 150% in the last decade, according to the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty. The most fortunate among the homeless population have vehicles they can use as shelter. But almost 40% of the cities surveyed by the nonprofit report have laws on the books that prohibit sleeping in cars. The Institute for the Study of Homelessness and Poverty at the Weingart Center estimates that during some part of the year, more than a quarter of a million men, women, and children experience homelessness in Los Angeles County. The LA City Council voted overwhelmingly, with just one councilman dissenting, to restrict sleeping in cars near homes, schools, and parks, just as voters approved a $1.2 billion loan to build more housing for the homeless. The council majority says the restrictions are an improvement. Critics on the street believe the move is insensitive and will push the homeless further into poverty. FSRN's Lena Nosferwitz has the story.
Familiar sightings at Southern California's famed Venice Beach Boardwalk include skaters, bodybuilders, neo-hippies, and street performers.
Them that's got shall get, them that's not shall lose. So the Bible says, and it still is news.
Sarah Scott sings in the parking lot of a law office located on the boardwalk. She's here on a sunny but brisk December day to seek help from volunteer lawyers at the Venice Homeless Citation Clinic.
Okay, I need the next person who isn't a check-in.
Okay. Tickets have accumulated on her vehicle that no longer runs and that for now doubles as her home. A month and a half ago, the singer-songwriter packed up her belongings and drove her Dodge Ram from Seattle, Washington to Venice, California.
Well, yeah, I'm looking for work and trying to figure out how to navigate in terms of living situations. The rents are really high, and I didn't come with a lot. I just came kind of with a dream.
Scott is one of an estimated 9,500 homeless men, women, and children in Los Angeles, one of the most expensive rental markets in the country, who share sleeping accommodations with a steering wheel. And they will have fewer places to lodge their wheels in the wake of a new ban by the LA City Council that will prohibit sleeping overnight in vehicles near residences, schools, and parks. Instead, those cars, trucks, and RVs will have to seek refuge in industrial or commercial parking lots.
Completely inappropriate, and it's just more of the same.
That's Peggy Lee Kennedy, who has been passionately fighting for the rights of the homeless since 2003. The passage of the ban came just one day after Los Angeles voters approved Proposition HHH, which authorizes more than $1.2 billion in bonds for the construction of 10,000 units of housing for the homeless. The bonds and the ban have been described as a carrot and stick, but Kennedy disagrees.
The stick is more like a mallet, and it's always like that. There's no solutions, and there's only punishment. And then they have this PR machine that comes out and says,
well, we just voted to get housing. But the fact is that housing doesn't exist right now, and the law is going to exist. So people don't know where to go. They will be criminalized.
All but one city council member voted for the ban. Councilman Marquise Harris-Dawson voted with the majority.
The other thing I want to point out is that there are thousands, hundreds of thousands of people that aren't here. Every neighborhood council, every church, every community group you go to, people are concerned that people have turned the curb in front of their house or their business into an apartment, essentially. And that's just not fair to anybody.
Legal Aid Foundation attorney Shayla Myers says the L.A. City Council has a history of criminalizing homelessness that dates back to the 80s with Ordinance 8502, which was struck down by the 9th District Court of Appeals 2 years ago.
So the new version of Los Angeles Municipal Code 8502 and its criminalization of people who are living in their vehicles in residential is by no means the first law passed by the city council to criminalize homelessness. So last summer, the city council passed another version of Los Angeles Municipal Code 5611, which places severe restrictions on individuals related to their personal property. That law was challenged in yet another lawsuit in which the Ninth Circuit again found that the city was operating potentially unconstitutionally in how they were using that ordinance. And so the city doubled down and passed another version of that law as well.
This is my first time being homeless. And I'm trying to pull out of it. All these new rules are making it impossible. They're just... sounds like they're trying to cripple people to the point where they have nothing and then just clean up the mess afterwards.
A financial hardship caused by a traffic accident about a year ago forced Joe, a carpenter by trade, to move into a two-seater sports car. He is fearful about being forced to park and sleep in an industrial area.
Sounds terrifying because I try to stay in a place where people know who I am.
That's a sentiment shared by singer-songwriter Sarah Scott.
Well, that's very unsafe, isn't it? Especially for females, single females, yeah.
Neither Joe nor Sarah knew much about the ordinance until asked by a reporter, and not knowing could drive them both further into homelessness. Violators of the ban will face fines.
The buildings came down, everything's changed about this town.
Before she became homeless, Sarah Scott wrote a song about the gentrification, or as she put it, the Starbucksification of Seattle. In many iconic California neighborhoods, rents are skyrocketing, with real estate developers catering to high earners from the tech industry. Apartmentlist.com puts the median monthly rent for a two-bedroom apartment in Venice, where Snapchat is based, at $5,200.
Money, you've got lots of friends.
But the woman who sings in the Venice Beach parking lot, wearing a neat black and white gingham dress and brown thong sandals, is optimistic. She's looking for work as a house cleaner if she has to, and she does not want to give up on the music. She has the drive, but just now she says her vehicle, though stalled, is the only thing that literally keeps her off the street. Lena Nozizwe, FSRN, Venice.
Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own.
Backpacks of Hope is a grassroots group serving houseless communities around the metro area. The recent freezing weather sparked crisis situations for thousands of local people without housing security. Last night, the rising waters of Johnson Creek prompted grassroots activists to scour the area for any campers who did not get the message. An emergency houseless resource drive is scheduled for tomorrow night, and here to talk about what's going on outside is Amanda Elizabeth from Backpacks of Hope. Thanks so much for coming back to see us again, and tell us what's going on.
We are hosting a huge winter survival drive collecting the necessities and supplies to help people get through what's supposed to be a pretty harsh winter.
And you have a drive tomorrow, and you've got 170 people signed up on social media. When is it, and what are you doing?
So it will be tomorrow, December 21st. We are holding it at a bar that's on 237 Northeast Broadway, and the doors will open up at 5 p.m. There will be free food, beer tokens, some speakers, and an opportunity for people to bring in, I mean, basically clean out their closets, bring in tents and coats, blankets. I mean, we have quite the list of needs that we have posted up on the event page. So,
and Amanda, who is participating, and who is in specifically, who's in the Portland Houseless Support Coalition?
Okay, so it's made up of Backpacks of Hope, Advocacy 5, Home PDX, Free Hot Soup, Right to Dream, Boots on the Ground, RVs for Families, Wagon Tails, PDX Outreach Nursing, The Village Coalition, The Miller Scholarship Foundation, Red Barn Outreach, and Camions of Care.
Wow, that's a lot of different organizations.
Yes.
So that we have so many of those organizations that need to come together to provide the basic materials for survival for people who are living without a home, what does that say to you about the state of how well people are taken care of by city?
What is that? I just think that I think the city could be doing a much better job, but I'm also really blessed and grateful to work with a bunch of these grassroots organizations who are willing to step up and do what it takes to keep people safe, warm, fed. You know, I try not to focus on what the city isn't doing and more of what we as a community are doing. So I think it's been great.
And Amanda, for people that aren't familiar with your organization, can you tell us a little bit about what you actually do on a day-to-day basis, and how did you get started?
Well, we take out, my group, we take out emergency supplies, backpacks filled with, you know, food, blankets and things like that, whatever we can stuff in there. We do outreach into the houseless camps. Mainly our focus is, you know, the southeast area for my particular group. And how I got started was I was actually homeless myself for 7 years. And then when I got on my feet, I started to do things like volunteering at shelters and soup kitchens. And then I decided to create my own group. So we've been going strong for a while.
And how closely do you work with these other organizations that are in this coalition?
Every day, whether it's, you know, talking to each other on the phone or going out together as a team. I think that that's one of the reasons why we wanted to do this drive, so that we as a whole could come up with a large amount of supplies rather than, you know, here and there. And it's been hard. You know, it's been a lot of legwork to try and get a hot meal out or a blanket out. So we're hoping that coming together and getting a bunch of supplies will kind of give us a leg up this winter.
Can you tell us a little bit about all the people that help you that go all over the city and find people that need shelter? And how do you find these people? How do you bring them together?
How do we find
the people that go out and locate the people that need your help and need some shelter?
Usually, it's by referral. Like, you know, we'll get a phone call from someone saying, you know, this person on, you know, in this area needs help, and whoever's closest or whoever provides that particular need will usually reach out and go and take care of that. As far as finding people who need shelter, if we are, you know, out and about doing outreach and we come across someone that looks like they
are in serious need of help will try and find open shelter space, which is really hard right now.
And how do you approach someone when you find them? And you know, like you said, you recognize they need some help or you think they need some help. How do you approach the situation? How do you open your conversation with them?
Simple conversation. How are you doing today? Learn their name, a little bit of their story. Ask questions. Don't assume, you know. So.
Okay.
And so from your personal experience and from doing the work that you're engaged in right now, what do you see as like the main barriers between people getting the basic necessities of what they need to survive through the winter? And just in general, do you see a recurring theme of people being unwilling to help people they see on the streets? Can you speak to some of those issues?
I think some of the hurdles that I see, people not having the proper housing or a place to lay their head at night to start with. Criminal background, mental health issues sometimes play a role, but I think that a lot of times the mental health issues happen after they've become homeless, but then it just becomes an ongoing vicious cycle. Not having the proper ID, transportation's huge, showers, things like that, all the things that we take for granted, little things they don't get to do to feel like a human being or to have any self-worth or any of that. I mean, just, or trying to get a job or any of that, not having a phone, all those little things that help. But from what I've seen, just being out there, I see a community growing and wanting to help more and more. They just don't know how, so.
And are there certain places where you tend to find more people, where the vulnerable people seem to go? Where are there places, you know, that you automatically go look? And
no, I mean, it's just all over. There's really no particular place that I go and seek out. Like I said, it's usually one of us getting a phone call from someone who doesn't maybe know how to help, and they'll say, I ran into this person, they need a hot meal, or this area looks like there's a newly formed camp, let's go check it out, let's see what we can bring to them. It's just a lot of referrals, phone calls, open communication, and so on.
It seems like there are a lot more businesses cropping up that are volunteering to be drop-off sites,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think that many people know about which businesses are volunteering to do this. So where can people go to find out where they can drop things off? I know that some of the first ideas that people come up with is Goodwill, but is that directly helping the community?
No. The drop-off locations for this, we have Antonio's Coffee Shop in Southwest Portland, and the address for that is 5645 Southwest Shoals Ferry Road. And then we actually have the other drop-off locations, or the camps R2D2. You can go there, or you can go to Hazelnut Grove. They're taking donations and holding them for us, and so that right now is what we have set in stone for drop-off locations. Another way is to contact one of the grassroots organizations that I mentioned and contact them directly, and there's always volunteers out picking things up directly from porches or someone's house or whatever works.
Do y'all have a website with any of this information with your locations?
Right now, you can go on Facebook, you can go to the event page itself, which is, you can go to Backpacks of Hope and message us directly, or one of the organizations that I mentioned, or you can go to the event and all the directions and the needs list is posted right there, and it has all the information.
What's at the top of that list? What sorts of things are in the most dire need?
Coats, socks, tents, boots. We're also asking for canned food, hot chocolate packets, hot cereal, any hand warmers, things that will keep people warm.
And how can individuals help you with this? I mean, what can they do? What's the most needed service that other individuals could do that would do the most good?
I think right now we're looking for volunteers to help pick up donations from the drop-off sites and help distribute once we start getting a volume of donations coming in. So,
I want to kind of ask a tougher question, emotionally speaking. Do you find that most local businesses overall and individuals are open to helping people who are in vulnerable positions that are economically troubled? Because online, and this is kind of where the dregs of humanity find a lot of voice, I'm seeing a lot of hateful comments on social media about people who are houseless. Can you talk about what you see in your work as the biggest challenges in that regard?
I see the same thing. Like I said at the beginning, I try not to focus on that, but it's a real issue and it's a real thing. You know, I see a lot of people discriminating against our houseless. They are all drug addicts or they're just freeloading or, you know, I've seen a lot of comments of if they can't afford rent, how can they afford that nice coat they're wearing or the tent that they're sleeping in or any of that? And the answer is, well, obviously those things are donated to them. I mean, that's what we do out here. But I do see a lot of businesses calling the authorities when they see someone sleeping on a sidewalk or not wanting to reach out. Or maybe they just don't know how. They're afraid. They don't know how to help. But I do see a lot of ugliness on that side of things, and it does break my heart.
And if you could address people who are like really have a strong desire to help but feel fear and are kind of experiencing paralysis from that, what would you say to them?
I think that the key is to open up dialogue, have a conversation with someone that you see out there struggling. You don't have to give anything at all. You don't have to hand them money. You don't have to do anything. Just have a conversation. I think that having a conversation is what really helps people to understand.
I think it helps them feel like they're not invisible, too.
Yeah.
That's kind of important for them to realize somebody saw me, somebody recognized me as another human being.
Yeah.
And just talk to me, because I bet a lot of them don't get talked to at all.
No, not at all.
And can you tell us again, tell us about the event tomorrow. I want to make sure everybody hears about this. When is it, where is it, and what would you like people to bring and to do?
Okay, so it is tomorrow. The doors will open up at 5 p.m. It will go till 8, and it is at a bar, but minors are allowed. Like, if you want to bring your children, there will be a bracelet given to the minors. The address is 237 Northeast Broadway, and that's in Portland. And some of the things that we are suggesting are winter coats, gloves, hats, tents, hand warmers, sleeping bags, boots, socks, tarps, also canned food, hot chocolate. We are also asking for help with pet supplies like dog coats, food, leashes, and crates to help our houseless animals as well.
I think that is about all the time we have, Amanda.
Okay.
But thank you so much for coming and speaking about this event. This is really important work, and we want to make sure we get the word out about events like this.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
That was Amanda Elizabeth with Backpacks of Hope. Connect with them on Facebook by searching for Backpacks of Hope or Rose City Backpacks of Hope.
Fatma Worley is organizing a local protest in support of the Syrian people. KBOO's Miriam Widman spoke with her today about the current situation there and why it's important to speak out locally.
So tell me what is going on with this protest. Give me some details about what is happening.
For sure. We are hosting a vigil and a march on Thursday at Pioneer Square at 6 p.m. And basically what we're doing is we're going to be bringing Syrian voices, share their concerns on what's going on in Aleppo with the recent outcries and the ceasefire, and also we're going to be having folks come out who are part of organizations that are helping Syrian refugees, and they're going to come out and share the situation and the crisis of the Syrian refugees that are on the ground living in Portland currently. And then we're going to have a couple of folks who are going to share solidarity statements. And the purpose of all of this is really to create an awareness on what's going on in Syria. It's been going on for about 5 years now, and unfortunately there hasn't been any mass media or any outcry from the people here on the ground in America. And with what happened on Saturday and in Aleppo, when folks started evacuating, people have realized that, you know, now it's really important that we start speaking out on this issue and we bring this to light and we push representatives to do something about this, because it's been going on for 5 years and, you know, it should have been stopped a while back, but, you know, it's gone on for too long and now enough is enough for them. And so really it's creating that awareness, bringing people and uniting them, and also hopefully discussing ways that we can work as a community in Portland to support our Syrian refugees, and also support the Syrians that are back home in Syria and learn from each other, really. And I think that's the most important part, is because we haven't had this space yet, this is going to be one of the first times that we're going to be uniting for Syria. And it's really important. It's a really significant moment, especially here in Portland.
Do you have any idea how many Syrian refugees there are in Portland or in Oregon?
In Oregon, I actually do not have the head count, but there's probably more than 40 families in Oregon for sure. I know that right now folks have been working with about 20 of the families that I've heard of, and they live out in the Tigard, Beaverton, Hillsborough area. And one of the organizations that's out in that area is actually working with them, providing tutoring, real life skills on, you know, how to ride the bus, basic English, and providing equipment for them so that they can, you know, provide meals for the families. So there's about 20 to 30 that I know of personally, but in Oregon, I haven't collected that number yet.
What are the organizations that are helping them? Is it Muslim community members? Is it Catholic or Christian church members? Is it secular people? Or who's helping them?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a number of organizations, honestly. And there have been numerous organizations within Portland. One of them is a Christian organization called the Lutheran Community Services of the Northwest and the Catholic Charities of Oregon. Both of them are Christian services, and they've been providing support for refugees